Welcome, and thank you for standing by. Today's call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. All participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star one on your phone to ask a question. I would now like to turn the conference over to John Bateman. Thank you, and you may begin.
All right, good morning, and thank you for joining this monthly climate update call, part of the suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm John Bateman with NOAA Communications, and I'll be facilitating the call today. If you have any additional questions after the conclusion of today's call, my colleague John Leslie and I can both be reached by email at, and I'll spell it, nesdis.pa@noaa.gov. Today's update will feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. A copy of the presentation our speakers will follow can be downloaded from the link in the media advisory, and I'll spell that link for you. It's https://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/sotc/brief-ings. With that, I'll introduce our speakers. The first presenter is Karen Gleason, a climatologist with NOAA's National Center for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the May U.S. and Global Climate Report, as well as the latest drought monitor update. Our second presenter is Patrick Marsh, Chief of the Science Support Branch at NOAA's Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma, who will provide a summary of 2020's spring season severe weather across the U.S., as well as review the nation's severe weather trends over the last decade. And our third presenter is Dan Collins, a meteorologist at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the temperature, precipitation, and drought outlook for the months of July, August, and September. Our first speaker will be Karen from NOAA.
Thank you, John, and thank you for joining today's call. We'll begin by reviewing the global conditions during the month of May, starting on slide two. Looking at the left hand of the slide, we see the global temperature percentiles map for May. Looking at the globe as a whole, land and ocean combined, the temperature anomaly was 0.95 degrees Celsius or 1.71 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean. This tied for the warmest May on record with 2016. Looking at global land only, the anomaly or the departure from average was 1.39 degrees Celsius or 2.50 degrees Fahrenheit. This translates to the warmest May on record for land only. And looking at the oceans only, we saw a departure from average of 0.79 degrees Celsius or 1.42 degrees Fahrenheit, and this translates to the second warmest May on record behind 2016. Looking more closely at the map, we see the most notable warmer than average to record warm percentiles seen across parts of Alaska, the southwest contiguous U.S., the Caribbean, parts of Western Europe, as well as North Asia. Cooler than average percentiles can be seen across the eastern United States and across parts of Canada, as well as Eastern Europe, Southwest Asia, and portions of Australia. Of note, there were no land or ocean areas that experienced record cold May temperatures. Regionally, the continent of Asia had its warmest May on record, and the Caribbean region experienced its second warmest May on record. Looking at the right side of the slide, slide number two, we're looking at our seasonal analysis. March through May is the most recent season, which is spring in the Northern Hemisphere and autumn or fall in the Southern Hemisphere. It was the second warmest three-month period behind 2016 for the spring season. Our departures from average for the globe, it was 1.06 degrees Celsius or 1.91 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Looking at land only, it was 1.74 degrees Celsius or 3.13 degrees Fahrenheit above the average. And looking at ocean only, it was 0.81 degrees Celsius or 1.46 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Looking at the map on the lower right-hand side, we see the most notable warmer than average to record warm percentiles. They were observed across Central and South America, the Gulf of Mexico, Europe, Africa, North Asia, and across parts of the Atlantic, Indian, and Pacific Oceans. Cooler than average percentiles can be seen across parts of Canada, the North Atlantic Ocean, Southwest Asia, and parts of the South Pacific and South Atlantic Oceans. There were no record cool percentiles observed for this three-month period. And regionally, South America, Asia, and the Gulf of Mexico had their warmest March through May period on record. Turning our attention now to slide three, on the left-hand side, we see the global temperature percentile map for our year-to-date period, January through May. It was the second warmest January through May on record behind 2016. Our global land and ocean areas combined had a departure from average of 1.1 degrees Celsius or 1.98 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Land only was 1.92 degrees Celsius or 3.46 degrees Fahrenheit above average, and global oceans only, it was 0.80 degrees Celsius or 1.44 degrees Fahrenheit above average. Looking at the map on the upper left-hand side, we see that above average to record warm percentiles were observed across a large portion of the northern half of Asia. Temperatures were at least 3.5 degrees Celsius or 6.3 degrees Fahrenheit above average for this year-to-date period. Also, we saw above average to record warm percentiles across portions of the Atlantic Ocean, Europe, South America, and Africa. Cooler than average percentiles were seen in pockets across the North Atlantic Ocean, Southwest Asia, and parts of the Southern Pacific and Indian Oceans. Again, no land or ocean areas experienced a record cold January through May temperature. And regionally, South America, Europe, Asia, and the Gulf of Mexico had their warmest year-to-date period on record. Looking at the Haywood plot on the right-hand side of the slide, we see the top 10 end of year, but by the end of the year, the global temperatures, the warmest departures from average on record, and 2020 is depicted by the black line with the black dot for each month. So January is just the January anomaly. January, February is an average of the 2 months depicted by the February marker, and then March is the average of the first 3 months and so forth. And we see that we are right behind 2016 for the warmest year on record and warmest year to date on record. Looking at our probability ranking outlook, the bar at the bottom of the slide, looking at our historical record, we see that it's virtually certain that by the end of the year, it will be, will likely rank in the top five warmest years on record. And there's also a 49.3% chance that we could end the year as the warmest year on record. Turning our attention now to slide number four, we'll zoom into the contiguous United States and look at our May temperature and precipitation percentiles. On average for temperature across the contiguous U.S., the temperature was 60.8 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 0.6 degrees Fahrenheit above average. This actually equates to a near average temperature percentile, so it's in the middle third of the historical distribution. Same for precipitation, where we saw 3.04 inches of precipitation averaged across the U.S. for the month of May, which is 0.13 inches above the long-term average. Turning our attention to the temperature percentiles map on the left-hand side of the slide, we see that below average temperatures occurred from the central plains to the east coast, and most notably, North Carolina had its coldest May since 2005 and ranked 10th coldest. Virginia was 12th coldest. Above average temperatures were seen from the Pacific Northwest or the Pacific Coast across the Rockies and down into Texas. New Mexico ranked 4th warmest for May and Arizona 5th warmest. Looking at the precipitation percentiles map on the right-hand side of the slide, we see that 16 states had above average precipitation for the month of May. North Carolina ranked third wettest, and South Carolina was fourth wettest. Drier than average conditions were observed across portions of the Southwest and the Rocky Mountains, across the Northern Tier, and parts of the Northeast. Utah ranked seventh driest for the month of May. All right, moving on to slide number five, we'll take a look at the spring season, March through May. This, for both temperature and precipitation, the averages turned out in the upper or the wettest and the warmest third of the historical distribution. On average, the temperature was 52.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 1.7 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean. Precipitation was 8.40 inches or 0.46 inches above that historical mean. Looking at the temperature percentiles map on the left, we see that above average temperatures dominated quite a bit of the contiguous U.S. from the west coast to the deep south and from the southeast up the Atlantic coast into New England and over towards the Great Lakes. Florida ranked second warmest, New Mexico fifth warmest, Louisiana had its sixth warmest spring on record, and no state ranked below average during the spring season. Looking at our precipitation percentiles map on the right-hand side, above average precipitation existed across Arizona and then from Texas to the Great Lakes and over towards the southeast. South Carolina ranked eighth wettest for March through May, and drier than average conditions were observed across parts of the Pacific Northwest, the Rockies, across the Northern Tier and Canadian border, and parts of the Northeast. Colorado and North Dakota had their ninth driest spring season on record. Turning our attention to slide number six now, we're looking at the year-to-date or January through May temperature and precipitation conditions. For temperature, we ranked ninth warmest for the year-to-date. Precipitation was above average or in that wettest third of the historical distribution. Temperature averaged 45.9 degrees Fahrenheit or 2.6 degrees Fahrenheit above the long-term mean, and precipitation over the first 5 months of the year averaged 13.60 inches or 1.21 inches above average. Looking at the temperature percentiles map on the left-hand side of the slide, we saw above average to record warm temperatures across the entire contiguous U.S. Florida ranked warmest for year-to-date, and there were six additional states from the southeast to towards New England that ranked among their warmest six year-to-date periods on record. No state ranked average or below average for this five-month period. Looking at the precipitation percentiles map on the right-hand side, we see above average precipitation stretching across from Texas towards the Great Lakes and towards the East Coast. Also, we note that Washington State was above average as well. Tennessee ranked wettest for this year-to-date period, and both South Carolina and North Carolina were third wettest. Drier than average conditions stretched from California to the Central Rockies and into the Northern Tier along the Canadian border. North Dakota ranked sixth driest, and Utah was seventh driest. Colorado trailing behind them at ninth driest on record for this spring period. Turning our attention now to slide number seven, the current U.S. drought from the U.S. Drought Monitor that was released this morning, valid on Tuesday, indicated that for the contiguous U.S., we had 23.4% of the contiguous U.S. in drought conditions. This is up about 5 percentage points since late May. We saw some significant improvements across Florida. There's just a tiny little bit of the panhandle that remains in drought at this point. But by and large, with drought growing, we saw drought amplifying, get deepening or expanding in spatial extent across parts of the northern Rockies and Plains, the western Great Lakes, the Great Basin, from the Great Basin to the High Plains, down towards New Mexico and Texas. And outside of the contiguous U.S., we saw drought expand and intensify across portions of Hawaii as well as Puerto Rico. And with that, I'll turn it over to Patrick.
Good morning and thank you. So thank everybody for attending this call. I'm going to take a few minutes to go through April and May severe seasons. And it's really a tale of two different severe seasons. If you look at slide number eight, this is an overview of all the preliminary storm reports that occurred during the month of April, and you can see the red dots represent tornadoes, and that will be consistent for all the images I will show. The blue dots represent preliminary reports of wind associated with thunderstorms in excess of 59 miles per hour or thunderstorm wind damage. And anything in green represents a hail report at least 1 inch in diameter or larger. And you can see that in April 2020, most of the activity is centered across the southern plains stretching towards the East Coast. And you'll notice a lot of the red dots associated from East Texas towards Georgia, and those are associated with a couple big tornado outbreaks that occurred in the month of April, and we'll focus a little bit more on those. In general, in April, the Storm Prediction Center issued 78 what we call convective watches, or watches that denote where we expect severe thunderstorms or tornadoes. 38 of those watches were specifically delineated severe thunderstorm watches, where we were expecting large hail or damaging thunderstorm winds, but predominantly not a tornado threat. We had 40 tornado watches issued during the month of April, and these are include the risk for large hail and damaging winds, but also specifically focus on the risk posed by tornadoes. Two of these 40 tornado watches were delineated particularly dangerous situation. This is a category the Storm Prediction Center uses to highlight when long track intense tornadoes would appear to be likely. And so two of those 40 tornado watches were a particularly dangerous situation. We issued 227 mesoscale discussions. Mesoscale discussions are short-term, highly focused technical meteorological information geared towards high-level meteorological users. So that would be local National Weather Service forecast offices, broadcast meteorologists, private sector meteorologists, and some emergency manager type folks. And so we issued 227 of those, which is about on par for what we would normally see in a month of April. Just about every day had a severe risk. 29 of the 30 had a severe risk reported during the day or forecast by the Storm Prediction Center, with 3 days being classified as a moderate risk or a level 4 out of 5 risk for significant severe weather. And you can see the count, the breakdown in the chart in the upper right. There were 40 tornado fatalities during the month of April. This is the most tornado fatalities in a single month since 41 fatalities occurred in May 2013. The majority of those fatalities occurred April 12th and 13th, in which 32 fatalities occurred. This is sometimes referred as the Easter tornado outbreak that started on Easter Sunday and continued into the early hours of Easter Monday. There were two fatalities on April 19th into April 20th. This was essentially a week at the weekend after the Easter outbreak. And then there were 6 tornado fatalities on April 22nd and 23rd. And so the subsequent slides, we will focus on these 3 events. Also of note, there were 14 killer tornadoes. So there were 14 different tornadoes that produced at least 1 fatality during the month of April. This is the 5th most number of killer tornadoes in a month, dating back to 1950, which is also known as the NOAA tornado record. And it's the most killer tornadoes in any month since 43 occurred in April of 2011, which was one of the more active, and it's actually the most active tornado month in the NOAA tornado record. And you can see the counts in the chart on the lower right. April was definitely very busy in terms of the number of tornadoes, and it actually is in keeping with April of 2019, which was also one of the busier tornado months. It's coming in at April 2019 was the fourth busiest month based on preliminary counts, and April 2020 was the second busiest of all Aprils for tornadoes. Taking a closer dive at the three tornado outbreaks that produced fatalities during the month of April, the Easter Sunday tornado outbreak arguably is the biggest tornado outbreak to occur in the United States since April 27, 2011, which is the April 27, 2011 is often referred to as the super outbreak or the super outbreak number two. There were to date that I can find there were approximately 114 confirmed tornadoes. These numbers won't become finalized until later this month or early next month. But with 114 confirmed tornadoes, this event is the third third most number of tornadoes that occurred in what we refer to in severe storms meteorology as a convective day or a thunderstorm day. The thunderstorm coverage tends to be a minimum early in the morning, and so we to group together outbreaks that are kind of continuations of the same outbreaks. We define in severe storms meteorology a convective day, and that is 8 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time the current day to 8 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time the following day. And so, using the convective day nomenclature, this is only if the Easter Sunday outbreak was only the fourth convective day with over 100 tornadoes. The last time that we had an event that produced that many tornadoes was the April 27th, 2011 tornado outbreak that produced 173 tornadoes. Of note regarding the April 27th tornado outbreak is that was actually part of a larger three-day tornado outbreak where April 26th, 2011, the day before, actually produced 110 tornadoes as well. So April of 2011, you had back-to-back days with over 100 tornadoes, which is unheard of in the NOAA tornado record. On the Easter Sunday tornado outbreak, there were 32 fatalities. This is the most number of fatalities on a single day, going back to March 2nd, 2012, which had 41. This was a tornado. The March 2nd, 2012 event was a tornado outbreak in the Ohio River Valley. It's the most number of violent tornadoes on a day since June 16th, 2014, and we define a violent tornado as a tornado that produces wind speed such that it would receive a rating, a damage rating of EF4 or EF5, the top tier, the highest level of tornado intensity. In fact, less than I think it's around 1 to 2% of all tornadoes achieve this a violent tornado rating. April Easter Sunday tornado outbreak was quite impressive from a meteorological standpoint, and a week later, the atmosphere kind of tried to do something similar again. There was another relatively big severe weather event across pretty much a lot of the same areas, maybe shifted ever so slightly farther south. Fortunately, there were only 26 preliminary tornadoes, but unfortunately there were still two tornado fatalities, one in Mississippi and one in Alabama. And then just a few days after the April 19th and 20th tornado outbreak, there was another tornado outbreak, this time a little bit centered more to the west, from south-central Oklahoma during the late afternoon, in which there were quite a few tornadoes, and there were two tornado fatalities. And then during the late afternoon into the evening and overnight hours, another area of tornadoes developed in east-central Texas, extending across Louisiana into parts of Mississippi. There were four tornado fatalities associated with this cluster of tornadoes, with the strongest tornado and the most fatalities occurring in east central Texas during the late afternoon. So April ended up being a very busy month, and it was very clustered towards the last week to 10 days of the month. the middle portion of the month. And then we moved into May of 2020. And while if you look at this map on slide 13, and I apologize for not keeping up with the slide numbers. If you look at slide 13, you'll see the preliminary May 2020 Storm Prediction Center received storm reports. And it may look like that's actually quite a bit, but for a May, this is actually well below normal for what you would expect to see the number of storm reports. In fact, if you look at May 2020 by the numbers, the Storm Prediction Center only issued 82 of our convective watches, 72 severe thunderstorm and 10 tornado watches. To put this into perspective, in 2019, which was admittedly a slightly more active, a slightly above normal tornado year, there were 186 186 tornado and severe thunderstorm watches during the month of May. So we were effectively less than half the number of severe thunderstorm and tornado watches during May of 2020. There were still 270 megascale discussion risks. There were 30 days with at least some severe threat posed. But this is the first time in the Storm Prediction Center's history, at least back to 2000, and I'm still trying to confirm going back to at least 1970. But it appears that this was the first May without a moderate risk or higher risk, so a level 4 or level 5 risk. So a very quiet, severe month. There was one fatality occurred in Louisiana on May 17th. This is the fewest number of May fatalities since 2018, in which there was also only one fatality. There was only one killer tornado in the month of May, which is, again, the fewest since 2018. But 2012 was the last time that we went through an entire May without a killer tornado. And if you look in the bottom right, the May tornado counts, just to show you how relatively quiet in terms of tornado production the month was, 2019, there were 556 preliminary reports with 513 actual tornadoes, which may seem pretty high since it's ranked number second, but generally speaking, May is one of the more active tornado months for the year. But May 2020 so far has only received 140 preliminary tornado reports, which is well below the long-term average and also the decadal average. Just to highlight the difference between May of 2019 and May of 2020, you can see the number of reports in the map in the upper left, where the plains were covered with red and blue and green dots, where we had very active a period starting from about May 17th through about May 30th of 2019. Compare that with May of 2020 in the lower right, and you don't see the density of the reports that you would normally see. In fact, probably the most notable event in May of 2020 actually occurred in the interior Pacific Northwest on May 30th. This was which is an enhanced risk or a level 3 of level 5, and it is the first time the Storm Prediction Center has ever issued a level 3 or enhanced risk in the Pacific Northwest. Granted, the enhanced risk has only been around since 2014, but going back and looking at the analogous forecast historically, we've only gone an equivalent forecast of this magnitude going one time previously in our history. So it's not very often that the month of May, the highlight of the month, is really the interior Pacific Northwest. And so that's pretty much all that I have. And so I will now turn it over to Dan.
Thanks, Patrick. Good morning, everyone. This is Dan Collins with the NOAA Climate Prediction Center, and I'm going to be talking about the climate outlook for the next 3 months, beginning July, August, and September. I'm going to begin on slide number 16, and with the outlook for El Nino and La Nina, or ENSO, as we call it. So looking at slide number 16, the image on the upper left shows the anomalies or departures from long-term normal average temperatures for sea surface temperature. We see that temperatures are continuing to be near to above normal for sea surface temperatures in the western equatorial or tropical Pacific, as well as across the northern Pacific. And we see below normal temperatures have emerged recently over the eastern equatorial Pacific along the equator east of the dateline to South America. The ocean and atmospheric conditions currently indicate that ENSO or El Niño and La Niña are neutral conditions. We neither have an El Niño or La Niña. And this is what we have had now for several months. We also see that there are above normal temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico and Caribbean, which plays a role in the climate over North America as well. Looking at the forecast for El Niño and La Niña, we see that we expect to continue with neutral conditions through this summer. The chances that we will continue as neutral conditions is about 60%. There's about an equal chance of an emerging La Niña during autumn or winter to maintaining neutral conditions, but there is a very little chance of the emergence of El Niño conditions, where El Niño conditions would refer to above normal temperatures over the central and eastern central equatorial Pacific. So we are more likely to go into a La Niña or to maintain neutral conditions. Each of those has about a 40 or 50% chance. Now I'm proceeding to slide number 17 and going to be describing the outlook for the month of July for temperature and precipitation. The outlooks are shown in terms of categories of above normal, below normal, or near normal. Generally, we show probabilities of above normal or below normal on the figures. On the left, you see the temperature outlook for July. You can see that the entirety of Alaska and the contiguous U.S. are expected or predicted to be likely above normal temperatures for the month of July. This is caused by a number of factors, including convection over the Indian Ocean, which tends to lead to a above normal temperatures over the central U.S. in particular, as well as long-term trends, decadal trends in climate, or other factors and dynamical model forecasts for the month. Looking at the image on the right of slide number 17 is the precipitation outlook. Again, we're showing above normal precipitation for the month. This is shown in green shades. The probability of above normal, probability of below normal is shown in browner shades. So we see that above normal precipitation is likely for July for much of the southeast region, as well as the mid-Atlantic and all along the Gulf Coast. The hurricane outlook from NOAA predicts an above normal hurricane season for the Atlantic, and this plays some role in the Gulf Coast above normal precipitation as well. We see that below normal is more likely for areas of the northern Rockies into the northern plains, and above normal precipitation is most likely for western Alaska for the month of July. Now I'm moving to slide number 18. This is our seasonal forecast for the months of July, August, and September combined. Again, the images show the likelihood of three categories, above normal, near normal, or below normal, depicting what the most likely category is. On the left, similar to the monthly outlook, we see that for the three-month season of July, August, and September, the average temperatures are likely to be above normal over nearly the entire U.S., including Alaska and the contiguous U.S. Temperatures are most likely to be above normal in the western U.S., where the long-term decadal trends are significant, as well as over the northeast U.S., where, again, the long-term decadal trends in temperature are a significant factor in the seasonal forecast, as well as dynamical model forecasts. Over the central CONUS, you see, that is the central contiguous U.S., you see that there's an area of white equal chances of above, below, or near normal temperatures over the central Mississippi Valley. This is an area where soil moisture is above normal currently, and as well, this is an area where the forecast is for increased chances of above normal precipitation going forward. So looking at the image on the right of slide number 18, you see the forecast for precipitation for the three-month season, July, August, September. There is likely above normal precipitation for southern areas of Alaska, as well as likely above normal precipitation for much of the eastern U.S., not including the Great Lakes region and the Northeast in particular, but otherwise above normal precipitation is likely from parts of the eastern Great Plains eastward to the Mid-Atlantic and Southeast. Below normal precipitation is predicted for the Northwest, extending east and south into the northern Rockies and central Rockies and parts of the southwest region. I'll now move to slide number 19. And this is the drought outlook. The drought outlook, unlike the seasonal outlook, begins with today and it includes the next 3 months of July, August, September, as well as the end of June. This map refers back to the drought monitor that you saw earlier, I believe on slide number 7. And this is indicating whether drought is expected to persist in the next 3 months to develop or to improve, or in some cases, complete removal of drought. So the areas of brown and yellow show the areas of persistence or development of drought. And you can see that over much of the western CONUS, where there is currently drought, it is expected to persist through the summer. You can see there's also areas of development predicted for parts of the central Rockies as well as the northern plains. However, you can see that there are areas shown in green where drought is likely to be removed in the next 3 months in the western Great Lakes region, as well as areas of the southern plains, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma. And some areas where the drought is more severe, the drought is expected to remain, but is expected to improve, and that's shown in the gray colors. This is the conclusion of my discussion of the outlooks for the next 3 months, and with that, I will turn presentation back over to John.
All right. Thanks so much, Dan. All right. Now we will take specific questions from the call participants. Please be sure to identify who you would like to answer the question if possible. And operator, could you please remind the call participants how they can ask a question and then please queue up the first question.
Sure. If you'd like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 from your phone, unmute your line, and speak your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. First question is from John Shorts. Your line is now open.
Hi, I guess this is for Dan Collins. Could you put the temperatures that we're talking about and especially the the heat that we're talking about in the context of the decadal trends that you mentioned. In other words, how does what we're seeing here in terms of second hottest May, second potential for hottest year, fit in with what we know about climate change? And thank you.
Well, I guess since you're asking about the forecast, we can't very well predict if it will be the hottest or the second hottest July or seasonal July, August, and September. If you're asking what is the chance of that occurring, we tend not to try to make that determination. It is true, given the current climate conditions and the forecast for above normal, that the occurrence of a record temperature in some parts of the country are more likely. However, we don't have a good means of predicting whether there will be record temperatures. Does that answer your question?
Well, it just says that I asked my question in a dumb way, and I probably should have asked Karen to put the figures that she the retrospective figures that she cited on May and the beginning of the year. How does that fit into what we know about climate change? And I apologize for starting off on the wrong foot.
All right, so this is Karen. Looking at the May information that I presented, it's important to note that there were some teleconnections that were associated with that particular weather pattern. So there's some interannual or year-to-year variability that factors into this. So the warm western U.S. and the cool eastern U.S. was by a large extent due to the fact that there was a strong ridge of high pressure over Alaska as well as the west coast from about May 6th to May 14th. And there was a trough over the east coast, and those were kind of the primary drivers for what we saw with the warm west, cool east coast during May. I don't know if that helps answer your question, but, you know, from month to month and year to year, we expect to see variability. When you're looking at long-term trends, we're looking to see how, you know, multiple months and multiple seasons year over year stack up, and if there's an overall trend towards warming or cooling or remaining the same. But for May in particular, we had a high amplitude, you know, pattern that caused a lot of warmth and some record warmth in parts of the West, and have a very cool May throughout much of the central U.S., the Ohio Valley, and certainly the East Coast.
Well, I don't want to hold people up if there are other questions, so thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to ask another question, please press star 1. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you so much, Saima. If there are no further questions, then I will wrap up the call. First, I'd like to thank all of our speakers for their time and everyone else for participating in this conference call. I will end by reminding you all to mark your calendar for some upcoming releases. The release of the June 2020 U.S. climate statistics is scheduled for July 8th. The release of the June 2020 global climate statistics is scheduled for July 13th. And the next media telecon for the June U.S. and Global Climate Report will be at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, July 16th. And finally, an audio file of this call will be posted on the NOAA.gov Media Advisory, which is online, and that will be later today. Now, if you have any further questions or need any more information, you're welcome to email me at john.jones-bateman@noaa.gov. And I will spell that, john.jones-bateman@noaa.gov. and my contact information is also available at the top of the media advisory. This concludes today's call. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining. You may disconnect at this time.